Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Seth Perler, and welcome again to the Executive Function Summit. I'm really excited today. We have Maria Rickert Hong from MariaRickertHong.com here today, and she is a holistic health coach that helps families figure out how to help their child, and we'll get into more about that later. She has at least two books that I know of that she's written or been a part of. One is called Almost Autism, and the other one is called Brain Under Attack, which has to do with autoimmune issues and how it affects learning and children. And I found out about her because I was on one of her webinars. She does a monthly webinar. She has an amazing website with it. It is full of excellent resources if you're trying to help your child with executive function or any other number of things. She has interviewed a lot of professionals and experts on her monthly webinar series. So you can check that out on the link right here or here, wherever that is. And Maria, hi, how are you doing today? What are we going to learn today?
Well, we're going to learn about therapies that can help kids that have executive function issues. And also, we're going to dig a little bit into why these kids may have these issues.
Okay, awesome. And in order to sort of set the foundation and set the stage for today, I'm going to go into a few rapid-fire questions. Tell us a little bit about who you are, not professionally, but personally. Who are you? What's important to you? What are your hobbies? Or
about you? Hobbies? I'm into genealogy right now, and I've been into it for about 5 years now. My sister and I have about 32,000 people in our tree. It all started because my dad died when I was 11, and he was a World War II veteran, and I really didn't know him very well. And I just wanted to know more about him. So it's sort of grown into this huge thing.
Cool. And do you mean 32,000 people that you're related to somehow, somewhere in the world?
Yes, either by marriage or genetically. And the cool thing is that we do it through Ancestry, but you can also take your information and put it into other sites like MyHeritage or Family Tree DNA and upload it there to see if you match anybody there. But with Ancestry, they can actually show you how you're related if there are enough family trees that have both you and that person's DNA in there. It's really cool.
That's a big number of people to be connected to. As you know, because we talked recently, I was adopted, yeah. So I don't know about my family tree history yet, but that's
fascinating. Yeah.
And then what is a holistic health counselor, and tell us about your professional background?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. How do I get into this, I guess is probably the question. So I used to be a sell side equity research analyst on Wall Street, and I used to cover oil service stocks because I used to work for Halliburton. And then I changed into a gaming, lodging, and leisure stock and learned the high yield side of things too. And so I became a really good financial analyst and could, supposedly I had some of the best spreadsheets on Wall Street for forecasting earnings. So I could tell you whether you would buy or sell a stock, right? But also knowing the debt piece as well. And I quit my job when my first son was born. I was living in New York City, and I'm glad that I did because he had a whole lot of health problems. He had projectile vomiting. He developed sudden hypotonia when he was 3 months old. He had developmental delays. He had sensory processing issues. He had asthma, you know, allergies. He had constipation. He was failure to thrive. And I'm trying to remember, but there were probably a few other things in there too.
So New York was a good place because there was a plethora of exposure to different approaches to really complicated issues like that?
Actually, no. Yeah. Okay. So I would take him to like some of the top allergists at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, and they're like, oh, it's fine. He doesn't have any problems with food. And come to find out, and this is sort of why I dove into what I'm doing, is that when they test, they're only looking for anaphylactic allergies, which are known as IgE allergies, but they don't look at things called IgG sensitivities, which are different from those skin prick tests that you get, the RASP tests. And so it can have a different sort of immune response, and those kinds of things very much affect the way that the brain and the immune system works, because most of the immune system actually is in the gut, And so it's kind of hard to talk specifically about one thing without diving into all these
Keep telling us how this got you into it, though.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so it was because my son had a really bad asthma episode. We had gone to LA, and there were some really bad forest fires, and came back, and, you know, from all the smoke inhalation, he almost had to go to the hospital. It was so bad. He was on the nebulizer. He was on Xopenex. He was on prednisone. He was on, you know, inhalers, all these kinds of things. And I had started to see a naturopath for myself. And I had started to see good results for myself. And I thought, well, let me just take my son in there and see what he can do. And the naturopath said, cut out dairy. I'm like, what? You know, we've been to a gastroenterologist. We've been to an allergist. And nobody ever said anything about that. They just said, oh, here's the Prevacid for his acid reflux. Right. Here's all the medication for his asthma. And oh, here, by the way, here's the Miralax for his chronic constipation caused by the Prevacid. And I said, okay, you know, I had seen good results. And so I cut out the dairy. And within a couple of days, he stopped throwing up after every meal. His asthma got better. His sensory issues started to get better. And I'm like, okay, what else is there? They're not telling me. And that was part of my big, big deep dive down into the rabbit hole and finding out what we call is a biomedical approach, which is really looking at those root causes.
Awesome. Thank you. And I don't want to get too far off topic, but I think it's really relevant now for people who are listening who have grown up in sort of this Western medicine world and who are used to sort of the pill for every ill approach and stuff like that. And they hear somebody talking about dairy or, for example, my dad went into ketosis a week and a half ago and he said his swelling is already down so much because he's not eating inflammatory foods right now.
Oh, yes.
He went into dietary ketosis purposely. And so anyhow, that there are these approaches that people are really skeptical about. Can you tell us just a little bit about background about holistic approaches or just a quick snippet about that?
Yeah, well, I will say, and this is what I had to do for myself.
You were skeptical too, by the way. You
were like, I was completely mainstream, right? Yeah. Like my son was on 10 different medications. He was drinking Pediasure every day. The pediatrician told me to take him to McDonald's because he had actually lost weight when he was 18 months old, right? So I'm like, okay, you know, this is what the doctor said. Mm-hmm. But what the functional medicine approach is, it's sort of taking a cue from the naturopaths that are out there. But it's studying it. And so there was a famous, I want to say he's a PhD, Jeffrey Bland, looked into what's called orthomolecular nutrition, which is probably one of the founding principles of functional medicine. And there are thousands and thousands of peer-reviewed medical research studies that are listed both in both books, the Almost Autism book, and then also in the Brain Under Attack book too, that your doctor isn't reading because, you know, pediatricians,
they're trained in Western medicine and
yeah. And you know, they go through their training in medical school. And then by the time they get out, they just don't have time. They're busy. They're dictated typically by insurance practices. And, you know, they can see your kid for maybe 15 minutes at a time. And the best outcome usually is, you know, either wait and see or here, take this medication. So they don't really have the time to dive deeply into these things. And what I've learned is that it takes about 17 years for what's showing up in these peer-reviewed studies, like, you know, all these different kinds of studies that I read, to show up in medical practice.
Cool. Thank you for saying that. I just really want parents to come at this today with an open mind and just know that there are so many great solutions out there. There's value in Western medicine. There's value in Eastern medicine. Yep. There's value all over the place, but we need to get the blinders off of thinking that there's only one way and really find what works. And I know that in my work with kids who struggle with executive function, I'm really looking at all kinds of things. It's not just tutoring and how do we get this kid to do their homework? Like there's so many many things that affect the whole big picture, and we really need to look at it from that perspective and look at it from a quality of life perspective. So how do you help families specifically? A family comes to you and they say, hey, we need help. Why do they come to you specifically?
Because I've gone through this myself. So the first book I wrote, Almost Autism, is mostly about my older son who had really, really severe sensory processing disorder. And it was so severe that whenever I looked up symptoms for it, that I would come up with autism. I'm like, I don't think he has autism because he was very, very verbal, but he was delayed socially and he was delayed physically, as well as having the sensory issues. So some of the symptoms overlapped with autism, but not all. And it was really kind of confusing to me. The problem is that it is not a diagnosis in the DSM-5, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that psychiatrists and psychiatrists will use to, you know, basically for coding for insurance purposes, right? So it's not a standalone diagnosis. And so because of that, it's not really given much weight yet. It's sort of lumped into autism. But in any case, I have recovered him to the point, he's just finishing up eighth grade, he's going into ninth grade, doesn't have an IEP, doesn't have a 504, does have a mild diagnosis of mild ADD, but it's, if we take care of some of the things, then he can do okay. And with a lot of the therapies and the interventions that I've done for him, he's able to do pretty well.
So what's your superpower as far as helping people struggle with executive function?
Well, the first thing is to undo stress. And so I really teach people, you know, it's not just yoga and meditation for their kids and breathing, although those things help tremendously, but understand how the body reacts. And a lot of that actually gets into the way that the body and the brain are wired together, and to have parents understand that. A lot of these kids, if they have autism or ADHD or sensory processing disorder or learning disabilities, we lump them together in what are called neurodevelopmental disorders. So just because I'm talking about my kid with sensory processing disorder, don't think it doesn't apply to your child, right? Because all of these kids have executive function issues, right? And yes. What we've found out is that kids who are typically developmentally delayed, like my son was, he crawled backwards when he was 8 months. When he finally crawled forwards, he crawled on his tummy, did army crawling. And then he crawled on his hands and his knees when he was 19 months old. And then he walked when he was 20 months old. Those are like some pretty severe developmental delays. And because of that, it means that his body and his brain were not wired together correctly, especially you need to make sure that baby is crawling on all fours. Because it wires the rest of the body with the vision, with the vestibular system, with auditory processing. And also, typically in a lot of these kids, they have what's called a retained Moro reflex, which is the startle reflex, right? So if a baby gets startled, he'll automatically sort of reach out for the mom. But a lot of these kids have not had that inhibited. And so it's still there, right? And that's one of the overarching primitive reflexes in kids today, that and the fear paralysis reflex. And so these kids are in a constant state of fight or flight. And when that happens, the brain shuts down. I mean, you got to think about it when you're in a state of, oh my God, you know, like when I was in New York and 9/11 happened, it's like, you know, you don't think, you just do, right?
Yeah. So you're really good at sort of seeing how the body and brain are developing, and these sort of inconsistencies, you're good at figuring out what those are and how, and alternative ways of addressing this so that the child can develop more effectively.
Yeah. So their body is healed, and to help parents understand, I'm really just a coach and a teacher, and I educate, right? Just like you do, to help them know that the body and the brain are connected, that just because their child has an executive function issue or focus or, you know, learning disability or whatever, you got to understand that that's very much connected to the rest of the body, and especially the gastrointestinal tract, because the body and the brain are connected, and the gut hosts about 70% of the body's immune system. And researchers have found out within the past few years that there are immune cells within the brain, which is really, really kind of interesting. And so we're looking at all of these neurodevelopmental disorders as more of a psychoneuroimmunological issue. And when you look at the body and the brain connected together like that, you can get a whole lot better performance out of everything, which is great.
Yeah, there is so much coming out right now about the gut biome and how important it is, and all of the microorganisms that are a part of us, or maybe that we are a host for, as some would suggest, which is really fascinating stuff. Because one of the things that I've seen consistently in 20 years of working with kids is a lot of kids who struggle with executive function have stomach issues in some way, shape, or form. And it's such a consistent strand. It really makes so much sense how related these things are. So I have two more questions for you, and then we'll really get into the meat of this today. How do you define executive function in one sentence?
Oh boy, one sentence.
I'll let you explain right after that.
I don't know if I can do it in one sentence. That's, geez. It's the ability.
Try one or two.
Prefrontal cortex of the brain to, it's more for abstract kind of things, for time management, for strategizing, for prioritization, for focus, attention, those kinds of things.
Tell us more. If I was a parent and I was like, what is this executive function thing? What's your frame on how, if I was like, I don't get it, how would you explain it?
It's called the mommy brain. It's called the mommy brain, right? And so that part of the brain does not develop until the child is about 25 years old, which is why insurance rates start to go down. And I think I've read that the brain, that part of the brain does not develop until about 30 years old these days. So basically it's the mommy brain. So this is why you're always having to remind your kid, hey, do your homework. Hey, do this. Hey, pay attention. Hey, whatever. Because your child's front part of the brain is still developing. And so I help with things that will help that develop better.
It's funny that you say that, because I have a lot of moms say something to the effect that they are their kid's executive function.
Yes. Yeah.
Cool. So let's unpack your expertise some more. So a client comes to you, and I want to, again, set the stage for people who are listening. So we'll do it sort of surfacey and then in some depth. But somebody comes to you and they're at point A and they say, Maria, we're at point A with our kid. This is what's going on. And we want to get to point B. How do you, in your work, define the point A to point B so that people who are watching can kind of relate to how this approach can help?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a process, right? And so it's not going to be something that you do overnight. Just understand that, right?
Because that's a recurring theme with all the speakers. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an educational process.
So they're at point A, and maybe it takes 6 months, a year, years, whatever. But what does that point A look like?
Point A for them is usually that their child is not doing so well in school, right? But that they also have all these other kinds of issues. And that's why I take a pretty full health history for that child to help the parent understand the background and how that child's health is actually affecting their ability in school.
And then point B, they've been working with you for a while. They really see some results and really things have changed for them. What's that look like?
Let's see. You know, the child is sleeping better, for one. That's huge. Maybe not so many GI, gastrointestinal kinds of issues. Better focus, better ability to pay attention, less stress, less anxiety. And when you get those kinds of things in line, then everything else just sort of falls into place, which is nice.
You can definitely execute better with all of those things getting better.
Yeah.
I'm going to mention some labels in a moment, but before I even get into them, what's the problem with labels?
That they don't look at the root causes. And so I'm also the media director of a nonprofit. It's called Epidemic Answers, ANSWERS.org. And we let parents know that recovery is possible from these neurodevelopmental disorders, as well as things like asthma, allergies, autoimmune disorders, and mood disorders. The problem with us is that people tend to get attached to the label. And so, you know, me as a parent, when I was trying to find out what was going on with my son, I'm looking up sensory processing this and sensory processing that. It's not looking at those root causes. But when you look at the root causes, all of those neurodevelopmental disorders, as well as autoimmune disorders and the mood disorders, they're all sort of the same underneath. It just depends on exposures and how it gets expressed. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. I talk a lot about iceberg theory, where we see the tip of the iceberg, but we don't see what's underneath the surface a lot of times. And that, I think, would be sort of your root causes. You know, I might look at it differently than you in turn, but we're both looking at what's beneath the surface. Because I'll see, you know, on the tip of the iceberg, you know, homework battles and missings and incompletes and late work and zeros and not studying and not knowing how to study and not using a planner and disorganization or what have you. But why is that going on? And so much of my work has to do with, let's look at the why, because what we tend to do is say, hey, just try harder. Hey, stop being lazy. Hey, get more motivated. And those things don't give the kids the tools that they need to have a transformative experience. So
they just beat up on themselves.
They start to internalize it. So we have these labels, and there are problems with labels because it often doesn't look at that, but there's also value in the labels. And I want to ask you, I have several here from your work that I just want to get a quick idea of how you would define the thing. You ready? What is autism?
Oh boy. It is a whole body disorder that means that a child usually has a problem with social skills. They may be nonverbal, usually language skills as well. It could be nonverbal or low verbal. But then you also have sensory processing issue in there.
Let's get to that in a second, because I'm going to ask about that. And what is almost autism?
Yeah. So that would be like my son, right? Who had the sensory processing disorder, like all the sensory issues, like sights and sounds and touches and feelings and vestibular motions and things can upset the child. That could be either sensory seekers or sensory avoiders or both. And all kids with sensory processing disorder do not necessarily have autism, but most kids with autism do have sensory processing disorder. And kids with learning disabilities and ADD, ADHD also typically have sensory issues that are undiagnosed.
And I feel like sensory issues is one of the most unnoticed things that I tend to see. It's such an internal thing for a person, the experience of their senses, that you can't look at somebody and say, oh, they're being distracted visually by all the lights and movement around them, or what have you, or the guinea pig in the classroom that the teacher has for a pet, every time it moves or makes a noise, like they're not filtering out that sound and able to, you know. So can you, I do want to unpack this a little bit more, because I do think it really affects executive function, sensory stuff does, because it prevents you from being able to execute and focus. So can you talk a little bit, I think it's missed so much. I think it's worth you telling us a little bit more. How do you know if your kid is struggling with some sensory things?
Well, take a look back at that child's development when they were little. So for my son, it really hit really hard when he was a couple of years old. That's when I really started to realize something was going on. He would cry about everything. And I'm like, that's what sent my health into a tailspin and why I started to go see a naturopath. But it was crying about, you know, the sounds being too loud. I couldn't take him to the grocery store with, you know, halfway in, he would just have a meltdown because the sounds were too loud. It's just weird for him. And so, you know, if I was lucky, I had my husband with me and he could take him out to the car, but you know, he couldn't swing on swings. or slide on slides or do the merry-go-round, you know, when he was just a little baby. And, you know, you try to write it off and, oh, ho, ho, you know, isn't he kind of cute or just not a good day? But after a while, it sort of builds up into a pattern and you start to see that there's something going on with this child that's a little bit different. Another thing that will show up is for my son, because he had such bad vestibular issues, is that he would do parallel play when he was 2-3 years old instead of playing with other kids. And that's because...
What is parallel play?
It's where they're looking at another child and maybe they're both playing with Legos, but they're not playing with each other. So they're not playing softball or something like that. And that's because if your vision is off and your vestibular system is off, you have a very poor awareness of where your body is in space. And so it is much safer for you to just stay there and let the other kids run around like little ping pong balls, because that's what most kids do, unless you have sensory avoiders like my kids were, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what it might look like for a little kid. For an older kid, it's going to be a little bit harder to tease apart, so you're really going to have to look back.
So what's a sensory avoider?
Yeah, so the lights are too bright, the sounds are too loud, the feelings are, you know, too rough and scratchy, you know, you got to tear all the tags out of your shirts. And I still do that.
Yeah. I sometimes, I have sensory issues, for lack of a better word, but sometimes I can't take the noise of something. And I feel so, different from the people around me. And I used to be like, why do I want to leave here? And I'm an extrovert too, but why do I want to leave right now? And all these people are perfectly happy with all this noise, but it's like, I'm hearing everything, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm fine with it and it can be soothing. But, so these kids with sensory issues, it's like, it's so, I feel like they're very intense, or they experience sensory input very intensely.
I have worked with a child who was so sensitive to sound that he could hear a butterfly flying by and it was annoying to the child. Right. And
how sad when, like, we don't see that and we're just like, no, we're going in the store. Why are you giving me a hard time?
Yeah. Blaming the child.
Yeah. And there's some, again, like you said, there's something going on beneath the surface that we need to take a look at. Cool. All right. So autism, almost autism, SPD, sensory processing disorder. What's ADHD?
Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
I mean, tell us.
Sorry. Well, then
I'm going back to the labels. Sorry if I was.
Sorry. Okay. And then ADD would be just the attention deficit without the hyperactivity. Right. And so it's just an inability to focus. And so if you're the ADHD kind, you're probably bouncing around a little bit more and not able to sit in your seat. A kid who has just ADD will probably look a little daydreamy and unfocused and not paying attention. Right. And that's the problem when you get into later, as you talk about with the 2E kids or the twice exceptional kids, right, is that a lot of times those kinds of focus issues can mask their giftedness, and their giftedness can mask their disability. So it's a real conundrum.
Yeah. And tell us about PANS and PANDAS.
Yeah. So that was the most recent book that I've worked on, Brain Under Attack, this one right here. So PANS is the overarching umbrella. It's a pediatric acute neuropsychiatric syndrome. And it can include things like Lyme disease, OCD, ODD, most mood disorders, as well as PANDAS, which is where you get this sudden onset of symptoms caused by a strep infection that has crossed over into the brain.
And I feel like this is something that goes undetected a lot as well. Is that right? So if a parent has never heard of this and they're watching right now, what do you tell them? Here, check it out. There's this thing called PANS. This is how you know to look deeper to see if it exists.
Yeah, if your kid typically has a sudden onset, although for my kids it wasn't as didn't seem to be as sudden onset at the time, but rages like anger or tics, like motor tics or physical tics or throat clearing tics. Academic regression, developmental regression, sudden onset of bedwetting, OCD, hand washing, those kinds of things, defiant kinds of things. And a lot of, here's where it's gets tricky is like if your child is in puberty or about to go into puberty, a lot of parents will just write it off and say, oh, well, it's just hormones. Mm-hmm. And yes, the hormones do play a huge part mm-hmm. of it, but don't let, you know, the two are not mutually exclusive, right? So you could have hormonal disorders or just growth as well as pandas.
And but, Lyme is actually under that umbrella as well, huh?
Yes. Yeah. And Lyme is another infection that can cross into the blood-brain barrier. And so you can have things like viruses or bacteria that can cross into the brain. And it used to be that we thought that there was this Berlin Wall of the blood-brain barrier and that it would keep everything out. And that is not the case. There is a lot of peer-reviewed medical research that's out there that I put into the book that shows that things like antibiotics, electromagnetic frequencies, concussions, things that are toxins like polysorbate 80 can open the blood-brain barrier and let these pathogens in. Once they're in, then it kind of may, your kid may look like they're crazy. So there actually is a documentary called My Kid Is Not Crazy that I recommend that you watch, because, you know, some of it's actually really sad where a child has this real severe, seemingly mental breakdown. And it's really just an infection that has crossed into the brain that is not being diagnosed or understood. And that's the problem, is that it's a clinical diagnosis and not a lot of clinicians or pediatricians know about it. So we try to educate people.
And then it goes untreated. And
yeah. Yeah.
So when you have students that you see with autism or almost autism or SPD, ADHD, PANS, what are some of the common executive function challenges that you see in your practice?
Oh, lack of focus, lack of attention. For my older son, it really hit when he was about fifth grade, and he would, you know, have some homework. It wasn't a whole lot, but he would just put it off and put it off and put it off. And it turned into this yelling match. And I'm like, I don't like this. I don't like the way this is going. So a lot of kids look like that. I actually, just to let you know what I did, was I took him to a brain balance program, which actually addresses some of those primitive reflex integrations that we're talking about. And it's a, not cheap, I will say, but within a 3-month period of time, then he started to do his homework. He was able to plan better. I don't have to tell him anything anymore. He just does it. I'm like, this is awesome, you know. And it's really from addressing those primitive retained reflexes.
So the brain balance essentially gave physical exercises that force the brain to process in a certain way that help connect some dots. Is that a good way to describe it?
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. There was a guy who developed the program. Maybe you could get him on. I don't know if it'd be this time, but maybe next year or something. Dr. Robert Melello, and he wrote a book called Disconnected Kids. And he talks about how a lot of these kids have very imbalanced brains. They tend to be, I think for the most part, very left-brained, which is very more seeing the trees for the forest, right? Mm-hmm. So they're not so good at the abstract stuff. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're better. Yeah.
So when families start working with you, what are some of the common blind spots that they have? They're trying to help their kid. They're trying to help their kid with executive function, but they're just missing the mark and they've just got some blind spots.
Well, just understanding how the health of the body affects the health of the brain, right? And so I educate them on food, what food is. It typically doesn't come in a box or a package, right? You got to cook it yourself and grow it from the farm, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. How food can help or hinder a child's brain and development. Those are probably some of the biggest blind spots. And then also trying to help them understand that this is a chronic disorder and that for chronic conditions, those pharmaceutical medications are typically, you know, those medications are really good for something acute. Like if you're in a car wreck or you're having an asthma episode and you can't breathe anymore, then certainly you would need the pharmaceutical medications. But if it's going on and on and on, then you want to start to address some of those root causes that we were talking about earlier.
So a lot of the medications are addressing the symptoms, but not doing anything necessarily to address the cause. So then the problem continues to be chronic. So
it's a Band-Aid,
So that's really good. Then let's look at that. What is food? You know, I don't think I understood this until, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago, but I would go to a certain fast food restaurant and I was a teacher at the time and I would go through the drive-thru and think, okay, this is chicken, this is potatoes, it's got a tomato on it and a piece of lettuce, this is healthy. And this one is healthier than the other one. And I don't eat that anymore because it's not, for me, what I consider food, you know, and I'm very aware, but it took me so long to understand that. How do you define food? This seems like such a silly conversation to have, right? But
I know, right?
Have it. So what is food, Maria?
There's a really good book by Michael Pollan, and he's the food columnist for the New York Times. Yep. It's called Food Rules. And he's, I think his mantra is eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Mm-hmm. You know, and anything that's made in a plant is not food. If it comes from, you know, if it is a plant, it's food. If it comes from a plant, it's not food, right? So anything that's processed is not food. But food is information, right? And the problem here in America that we have is that I used to think that the USDA and the FDA and the EPA and everybody have got our backs. But what I came to understand is that just because it is sold does not mean that it is safe. There's very little safety testing that goes on. Most of the safety testing that does happen is actually by the companies themselves, like Monsanto and their glyphosate, who are now being found out that, you know, three cases so far have shown that glyphosate, which is a carcinogenic pesticide, it's also antibiotic pesticide, has caused lymphoma, a type of cancer, right? And that's sprayed on all of the wheat, unless it's organic. All of your genetically modified crops like corn and soy. And those pesticides actually affect the way the brain develops. And there have been a lot of studies that have shown how organochlorine pesticides can affect the brain and its development. There is the Children's Health Center out of Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. And Philip Landrigan is the guy who's headed it up, and he's actually done some really, really good research that looks at how different kind of toxins that are in the environment, and especially on our food, affect our children's health and also neurodevelopment. So in a nutshell.
Yeah, I think it's such a complicated issue because it's really out of sight, out of mind. Like we go into a grocery store, we don't see them spraying pesticides, poison on food at the grocery store. We don't see that part of it. Right. We don't see what's happened in the fields. We don't see what's happened to the soil for years or decades. We don't see what happens when they're producing, for example, fertilizers or, and I'm no expert in this stuff at all, but I definitely know that my life feels better. I do generally eat organic, a lot of plants. Mm-hmm. And my easy rule is I try to do 2/3 of my plate plants.
Yeah, that's great.
But I'm not a vegetarian, but I hardly eat meat anymore at all. Mm-hmm. But I feel differently. I look different and I have better energy and so on and so forth. But there's so much stuff in our food.
Yeah.
That we don't see.
Right. That's part of the basic, you know, education about what food is, right? And then you got to go on from there and say, well, then there are specific diets that may help your child, say like a gluten-free, dairy-free diet or
Feingold
or a ketogenic diet like your dad's flavors and preservatives, which if you lived in Europe, that wouldn't be an issue for the most part because I don't know if you've ever looked at labels on European packaged food, but it'll have like some pretty severe warnings, and or they just don't allow a lot of the substances in their foods that we do here, like Kraft macaroni and cheese. It's probably changed by now, but here we have like FDNC yellow, I forget what the numbers are, that are not allowed in European foods because they're known to cause things like hyperactivity and allergies and potentially lead to cancer, things like that. So yeah, just because it's sold doesn't mean it's safe. So you have to educate. Yeah.
Okay, great, great. What are some common mistakes that people who start working with you that they're doing? What do you see all the time that you're just like, yeah, you're trying to help, but this is not helping. This is might be aggravating things.
Trying to be too perfect, I think, right? That can be what's called orthorexia. Like I have to do it perfectly or not at all. And that's part, and I went through that too. And maybe you did too. I don't know when you first started going through this thing with food and it's like, I could never eat anything that's not organic anymore. Or, you know, because it's very, very overwhelming to have your world turned upside down and to realize that all these agencies that we thought were protecting us are not doing their jobs. And so a parent can really get caught up in that. And so that's one of the things. And I will also say that it is a really good thing for if you're implementing a special diet for your child, have the whole family do it too. It's just easier. You don't want to single out that child and make them feel awful or different. It's hard enough when they're in social situations at school, but to have that happen at home, you don't want that. So
I think that's a really good point also about the sort of perfectionism with this. And what, you know, I talk a lot with parents about that. I see a lot of parental guilt, parents feeling like they're just not doing it right. And feel really bad about it. And it's like, we just are where we are and we move forward with a baby step from there. So what's a step, let's say with the diet that's pretty easy for a family to implement if there is one?
Yeah. Well, honestly, taking out the dairy was, it sounds hard because I mean, my kid, they told me to feed him everything loaded with dairy, cheese and yogurt and ice cream and macaroni and cheese pizza and whatever, because it's full of fat and full of calories. And they didn't realize that it was very much contributing to his issues. But actually cutting out the dairy was not as hard as what I thought it would be, because there are dairy-free alternatives left and right these days. And so I would say have your parents try that for a few days, maybe a week or so, and just see. You know, it's going to be a little bit harder if the child isn't in school.
Right? But so, that's sort of like the elimination diet approach, like eliminate dairy, see what happens.
Yeah.
And then if you want, you can reintroduce it, but really give that one a chance. That's one of the big ones you would suggest.
And you would keep a food journal at the same time. And because a dairy sensitivity is not the same thing as a dairy allergy, it's going to take a few hours or a couple of days for the symptoms to appear. And it might be something like all of a sudden your child is just sort of spacing out a whole lot more, or they have chronic constipation, or their stomach hurts, or all of a sudden their nose starts dripping, or they get the dark circles under their eyes, or their tummy starts swelling up, you know, something like that, where they have a headache. And so just keep an eye out. And once you really start to make the connection between diet and behavior, because behavior is not your kid being bad. Behavior is really just a way for that symptom to express itself because your child doesn't know any different. They think that that's how everybody else feels, and that's not the case, right? And so they don't know any better. And so, and actually having the parent do that at the same time may really make it sealed in too, because the apple usually doesn't fall from the tree, especially mom.
Yeah, I think we as adults too are, especially in our culture, are very unaware of how food affects us. So it's just really taken me a long time to change the way I've eaten, to really start to see. Now, if I haven't eaten something for a while and I have it, I can be like, whoa, that I can see how dramatic the effect is, because it's it's not there. Whereas before it was just like, oh, this is how, yep, I just always feel bloated after eating, or I always whatever. And, and it's like, that's not normal. And I now know that. But I didn't. Well, let's dive into some therapies that help with executive function.
Right. So I talked a little bit about it earlier when I talked about brain balance, right? And so that's one of the therapies that I was talking about can help with primitive reflex integration.
Can you tell us that one again? So what is primitive reflex integration?
Okay. So a baby is sort of programmed, I guess, I don't know, through their DNA or something, that certain neurological movements will appear and then sort of meld into the body as the body and the brain develop, right? And some of those actually come into play when the baby is in utero, you know, so that the baby can make it out of the birth canal properly, right?
So there are these normal reflexes that babies have, right? Yes. That they're old, they're primitive, but they're very normal developmentally. They're supposed to happen.
Yes. And they're supposed to appear and then they're supposed to
integrate.
Yes.
Meaning that they, you could say grow out of it, but for lack
of grow into it. Like it just sort of absorbs into the body, I guess. Right. But for a lot of kids, and I want to say probably all or most kids with neurodevelopmental disorders have primitive reflexes that are retained, whereas their body didn't integrate them.
And so it didn't integrate it.
Did not. So.
So there are certain therapies that help with executive function that help them to integrate it since it hasn't been integrated and it's developmentally delayed.
Yeah. And so it helps to rewire the body and the brain together. And so it is doing certain physical exercises to help, they say, if it fires together, it wires together, right? You've probably heard that before, right? And so doing certain bilateral movements or, you know, there are all these different kinds of movements, lots of different kinds of reflexes that could be retained. There are some really great books about it. The best one that I have is actually this one. I don't even know if it's available anymore, but it's by Sally Goddard Blythe. It's Reflexes, Learning, and Behavior. And she's actually got some tests in here that you could do at home to test for, let's say, the spinal gallant reflex or something like that, and how you do it and how you test for it, you know, if your child is sitting up or lying down or something, and, you know, you can test for it, right? And so then if those reflexes are retained and not integrated, then it causes problems later on with core muscle strength, with focus, with attention, with learning, you know, all those higher level functions, because it wasn't taken care of when the child was an infant.
Makes so much sense, but it's something that this is not my at all. And I'm not even aware of this stuff. And I'm just like, this is a whole new world for me to start diving into. But so much of, again, you and I both, we're still dealing with what's underneath the tip of the iceberg. This is just stuff under the tip that I don't even know. So this is cool. So what about, now I do know a little bit about vision therapy because I know a local vision therapist that I've been in contact with for a few years, but tell, what's vision therapy?
Okay. So
how does that help with executive function?
So the question is, what is vision, right? So a lot of people think that vision is, you know, what you see, can you see 20/20? That's not vision. That's called acuity. Vision is how your brain processes what's coming into it. And for a lot of these kids, I want to say a very large chunk of them, their vision isn't working properly. And it is the sense that takes up about 80% of the bandwidth of the brain's power. And so if the vision is off, the rest of the brain isn't going to work very well. So a lot of these kids have problems with tracking and teaming of their eyes. Now think of it, if you've ever gotten a concussion or if you've ever been hit in the head, what's the first thing they do? They shine that light in your eyes. Yeah, and they want to look at the pupils. Are the pupils dilating and or contracting properly? Are your eyes able to follow the pen, the motion of the pen? Mm-hmm. And there is a very sophisticated test that those developmental optometrists, or they're also called behavioral optometrists, can do. It's separate from the acuity test. where they can check to see if your child's eyes are teaming and tracking together. And so a very obvious thing would be if the child has what's called a strabismus, where there's a turn of the eye, right? I actually have a slight one myself where it may turn out that way a little bit. Some kids may look like they're cross-eyed or something, but sometimes it's really not obvious. And it's only when you take your child.
Very subtle, yeah.
But going through the vision therapy, we did it for about 6 months, and it's some really wacky kind of exercises. It's kind of fun. You do it at home for 10, 15 minutes, 3 or 4 days a week, and then you go in once a week to the vision therapist. And a lot of times it's covered by insurance, which is great. And it can really help.
A lot of it has to do with the musculature behind the eyes and getting the eyes to work in sync better.
Yes. So the funny thing is that if your child has a strabismus, right, your eye doctor, like an ophthalmologist, would say, oh, let's do a corrective surgery. It's not the muscle that's the problem. It's the brain telling the muscle what to do that's the problem. And so by doing different kinds of eye exercises, you may be able to avoid that kind of surgery.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
And then as we go down this, it just, I'm getting overwhelmed. I love it, but I'm getting overwhelmed, like thinking about parents watching this going, oh, what?
It's
there's
interesting.
So many things to look out for.
Yeah.
But we really do need to look out for this stuff, because if we can sometimes find one, if a parent can find like one game changing thing, I mean, there may be several things that are still developmentally out of sync or what have you, but when we can find some of these game changers and really work on that and see differences, it makes a difference. So,
it's
overwhelming to sort of know where to start. But let's get with what is auditory therapy.
Well, and you were referring to that earlier, right? When you said how you'd walk into a room and there would be the sound that would be really annoying to you, but not to everybody else. And my sister and I used to be like that too when we were little, and we'd walk into a department store and we could hear the security system.
Or the fluorescent lights or the air conditioner or things that people kind of tune out. Yeah.
So for a kid with auditory processing disorder, it all sort of also goes back, as well as the vision therapy does, to those primitive reflexes, right? And so if they weren't integrated properly, then the body and the brain weren't connected properly and all the senses won't be working properly. So auditory processing issues come from when it's not necessarily that all frequencies may be too loud. It may be just different ranges of frequencies. And so you have to get somebody that can test for those different ranges of frequencies. And it's not always an ear, nose, and throat doctor or an audiologist. I will say that if you come onto the Epidemic Answers website, we actually have information about all these different kinds of issues that we're talking about, the sensory issues, the vision, the auditory, the food, the toxicity, all these
kinds
of
things. People can start to go down that rabbit hole in a sane way.
Yeah, we also have practitioners on there too, right? But if your child has auditory processing issues, like my son did, then he may look like he's just sort of not paying attention, but maybe he just doesn't hear that frequency of the teacher's voice very well, right? And so she may be talking really loud, but it doesn't seem that way to him, or something that is really what would be kind of mild to us could be loud to that child.
Yeah.
And so there are different kinds of auditory therapies that can be done, like AIT, which is what we did. It's the Berard method. That's the auditory integration therapy, or there's integrated listening, or there's the Stephen Porges Safe and Sound protocol, those kinds of things. That look at different auditory ranges and help just by listening. I don't know how they design it, but there is a series of music, sound, songs, whatever, that have been shown to help with certain ranges of frequencies to help counteract that.
Okay, so let's tell us a little bit about what neurofeedback is, and then let's look at some biomedical approaches. So finally, neurofeedback, how can that help with executive function? What is it?
Well, first of all, it's, you know what biofeedback is, right? It's where you're able to...
I do, but the people watching probably...
Yeah. Okay, it's where you can control your, let's say, blood pressure or your heart rate just by breathing in a certain way, like taking deep breaths, like in through your nose, out through your mouth, right? That's an easy one to do. You can get apps that can sort of track you, and you can, that's a feedback. It's a feedback loop that you can see the results. So neurofeedback is similar, but it has sensors that are put onto the scalp, and it's an EEG. So it's called a quantum EEG, and it looks at the different ranges of brain waves that are produced. And some of them may be alpha, beta, delta, theta. I think there may be gamma, I'm not really sure. But if the child is high or low in some of those frequencies, then it could affect their attention and their learning and their executive function, right? And so what neurofeedback does, it's actually really simple. Your child will go into the neurofeedback practitioner with a set program, what they're trying to help correct. And they get to pick usually whatever kind of movie or TV show or whatever they want to watch. And they have to control so if their brain isn't producing the correct wavelengths that are wanted, then it'll sort of go dim and dark and everything. And then
it's giving the person feedback.
Yeah.
And they have to use the way that they're thinking essentially to, the sensors will pick up on if they're regulating certain things, and will.
You don't have to, and the nice thing is you don't have to think.
Sorry,
about it.
Audience, if I'm not explaining it very well. I've done neurofeedback before,
yeah,
but it's.
Yeah. You don't have to think about it when you're doing it, though. You just do it.
Oh, yeah, right? Yeah.
Which is kind of neat. And
you
so
don't have to consciously think about it, but it's giving you feedback that your brain is able to sort of tap into itself to regulate, right?
Right, yeah. And so at the very base level, there would be anxiety. And so anxiety cuts off that prefrontal cortex right here that has a lot of the executive function,
yeah.
Right?
Yep.
It just shuts it off, right? And so a lot of these kids have anxiety, right? Am I right? Mm-hmm. So it's going to help with that. It's not the only thing that can help with anxiety, but it is one of the things. It can also help with ADD, ADHD. It is recognized by the American Academy of Pediatrics as a tier one or level one intervention for ADD, ADHD, meaning it is just as good as medication. And there's no harmful side effect like there is from a pharmaceutical medication, right? Which is nice. And a lot of insurance companies will actually pay for it. You just have to ask, right? So.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of people don't even know what it is. So asking, yeah. Okay.
You can find practitioners on the Epidemic Answers website too. We have vision therapy, auditory therapy, neurofeedback, whatever.
And if you're trying to help with executive function and you want to take a biomedical approach, first of all, what's a biomedical approach?
It's looking at those six different root causes, looking at toxicity, gut dysbiosis, like you were talking about, immune dysregulation, inflammation, nutritional deficiencies, and hormonal imbalances. And all of those can be measured and quantified, right?
So what's toxicity?
Oh, God.
just briefly, like if a parent's like, toxicity, what?
Yeah. Well, there was a report put up by the Environmental Working Group in 2005, and it's called Body Burden, the Pollution in Newborns. And it showed that newborn babies, because they measured the cord blood from a newborn, meaning that it could only have come from the mother, and they found an average of 200 different toxic chemicals in the cord blood, up to 287 different kinds. We're talking heavy metals. We're talking carcinogens, different kinds of endocrine disruptors and pesticides that are in there. It's like
we are exposed to so much now.
Yeah. Yeah. And it gets passed from generation to generation. This is why you're told when, you know, moms are told when they're pregnant, don't eat fatty fish, big fatty fish, because the toxins will bioaccumulate from fish to fish to fish, and it gets stored in the fat. And the same thing happens to us too, if we're not detoxing. And I don't mean detoxing, just drinking a lot of green juice. I mean, detoxing, are you working with a functional medicine doctor and or a naturopath? I personally recommend the naturopath to help you eliminate a lot of those toxins. Then yes, you are passing that on to your child. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of horrible to say, and I don't mean to blame moms.
Out of sight, out of mind. Like these things you don't see, for example, off-gassing, you know?
Yeah. From your mercury fillings. Yeah. You
know? So now gut dysbiosis seems more straightforward. Gut problems, mm-hmm. let's just keep it simple with that. Immune mm-hmm. dysregulation, I assume that means problems with the immune system.
Yeah, and that really stems from a lot from the gut, like we were talking about, right? And then it also goes into the brain because the gut and the brain are connected and the brain also has an immune system. So chances are most of your kids out there have allergies or eczema or asthma, constipation, you know, that's a sign of both as well. Either chronic constipation or chronic diarrhea, chronic runny noses. They have seasonal allergies or full-time allergies, you know, all those seemingly normal. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was a kid, kids didn't have these kinds of issues, mm-hmm. right? They just didn't.
And inflammation is a root cause.
Right. And in the case of kids with neurodevelopmental disorders, it can turn into neuroinflammation, right?
Again, hard to see, right?
Yeah, you wouldn't. There was a really good article put out by the journal Nature a few years ago, and it talked about how a child's head circumference percentile, if it grew when they were a baby, then they are much more likely to develop autism, I would add on to that, or another neurodevelopmental disorder. So for my kids, they went from the 10th to the 95th percentile and then the 22nd to the 95th percentile in head circumference percentile. So that's something that parents would want to go back and take a look at because pediatricians haven't really been trained to look at that.
Yeah.
But that's a sign of inflammation and a swelling. It's encephalopathy that's going on within the brain.
And is there anything else you want to mention about biomedical approaches?
Yeah, well, a lot of it stems from nutritional deficiencies, right? And so people that are into the biomedical world or the orthomolecular world will look at correcting a lot of these imbalances with nutritional supplementation. I don't mean just going to the grocery store or the pharmacy, you know, to get the stuff that they sell on the shelves, because I will say there has to be, there are particular forms of vitamins and minerals that are beneficial and particular forms that are actually harmful and toxic. Mm-hmm. And so you really need to know what the difference is. And you need to work with somebody that knows what the difference is. After a while, you may be able to figure it out for yourself. Mm-hmm. But, you know, going back to, let's say, your auditory processing issue, right? A lot of these kids that have auditory processing issues actually have a magnesium deficiency. And you're going to have a magnesium deficiency if you're in a constant state of stress. Like I said before, a lot of these kids are in a constant state of fight or flight. And so they will burn through magnesium. And if you burn through that, then your ability to hear well is not going to be very good. You're also probably going to be constipated too. Yeah. And more prone to asthma and things like that. And have problems sleeping because magnesium actually helps with all of those things, right? And so if you go to your pediatrician, they may or may not know about these kinds of things. If you were like me and I'd been through quite a few pediatricians, they pretty much all blew me off and said, oh, well, we don't believe in all those studies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, magnesium is one of the things that I take daily.
Yes.
But I really did a lot of research to find which one I wanted to take that was bioavailable, that my body could absorb properly. And mm-hmm. So anything else on the biomedical?
Yeah. I mean, there's tons. I mean,
just what else you want to mention. And then what I want to get into as we wrap up is what actions do you want parents to take this week? But what else do we need to know about biomedical?
Well, I mean, so it could look at probiotic supplementation. It could look at other vitamins and minerals that you would supplement. A lot of these kids have vitamin D deficiencies. There have been a lot of studies that have shown these kids have very low levels of vitamin D. You know, they're on screens all the time. They don't get outside to play in the sun. And it's just, they just don't have good levels of vitamin D. And if they don't, then their immune system is not going to function very well. I will say that what is normal vitamin D is not optimal vitamin D. You need to understand that. So there is a a doctor that I like to follow, Dr. Sherry Rogers, MD. And she's written a bunch of books like Detoxify or Die, which sounds really horrible. but they're good to read. And she has a really good newsletter called the Total Wellness Newsletter. And she says you really want to have between 80 and 100 for the blood test of vitamin D for it to be optimal. Whereas if you go to a regular doctor, they would say 20 or 30 is normal. But you have to remember the rest of the population is not functioning.
That's very the thing. Well, that's one of the things where it's like everybody in America has a vitamin D deficiency, right?
Yeah.
Or they, you know. Oh, it's so common. Okay. So in the next week, what specific actions can parents take to help their child with your approaches, your insights? What actions should parents take this week?
Well, I always like to start with sleep. Make sure that child gets enough rest. I find that most kids go to bed way too late. You want to have what's called good sleep hygiene, so no electronics in the bedroom at all. So no phones, no iPads, no computers, no TVs. It's going to be a real fight, I can tell. With a lot of people, you also want to turn the Wi-Fi off at least at night if you can, because that actually does affect the way that the brain functions and the brain detoxifies at night. And if it is being bombarded with electromagnetic frequencies from things like cell phones and Wi-Fis, then it will not detoxify well.
I thought that was the craziest thing when I heard it, and then I started sleeping. I don't keep a TV in the bedroom anyway, but I started sleeping without the cell phone or computer in the room, and I don't have an alarm clock in the room. It's just very, and I sleep better like that for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe just because the idea of having that stimulus in terms of our computer not being there is helping me sleep better, or may have to do with the...
It's addictive, right? I mean, I get addicted to it too, right?
So sleep, like that's the interesting, that's the number one thing.
Yes.
Really something to take so seriously because it affects executive function so deeply, especially when I'm working with teenagers who are staying up to 1 or 2 in the morning, and then they have to wake up at 6 or whatever to get to high school. You're not going to be able to execute. Your mood's going to be affected. It's going to affect everything.
I get stupid when I'm really tired and don't get enough sleep.
Yeah.
I remember like literally almost just walking into traffic. I was so tired and not really caring about it, you know, because it's just like not getting enough sleep. So it's very important.
What's one more action you would want them to take this week?
Let's see. I would look at some elimination diet issues. And so look at the dairy. And just see if you could try switching out some of those dairy-filled foods with non-dairy versions. You know, maybe you like ice cream. There are coconut ice creams and or nut cream ice creams that are really good. There are cheeses made from nut cheeses that are really good. You know, there are ways to do it. These days, you'd really have to just live in a cave not to be able to find alternatives. So
yeah. Cool. Anything else before I have one final question?
I'm going to stop there because I can just go on and on and on.
My last question, from your heart to theirs, what is the most important takeaway you hope people will leave with right now?
Oh, that your child is trying so hard, that they really want to do well, and they, because of the way they have developed, they're going to have to work extra hard. But by you as the parent helping to implement some of these things, you can help to take off some of those restrictions that would really move the needle for them and hopefully have them gain some confidence in themselves.
Awesome. I love that. They are trying hard. And that's one of the things that the one of the misunderstandings so often is you just need to try harder. And it's like, you have no idea how hard, especially kids with sensory stuff, and how hard it is for them to just filter out the world and be able to focus on things. But anyhow, thank you so much, Maria. I really appreciate you taking the time and your expertise to share with all of us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Hopefully it wasn't too earth-shattering.
It was great. Thank you so much.
All right, sounds good.